Welcome back to Radio Who, What, Why. I'm Jeff Scheckman. In March of 2000, the acclaimed conceptual artist Mark Lombardi was found hanged in his New York apartment. It was ruled a suicide, but Mark Lombardi was no ordinary artist. His work, interlocks as they were called, art that was also information, shined light on the Vatican, the Mafia, the Bushes, international financiers, and the CIA. In the words of his biographer Patricia Goldstone, his death transformed itself into the ultimate piece of conceptual art. In fact, after his death, Lombardi's work drew the attention of the most influential art museums in the world, as well as the FBI and the CIA. Patricia Goldstone has been a reporter for the Los Angeles Times and a bureau chief for Cablevision. She's written for the Washington Post, Maclean's, and the Economist Intelligence Unit. She's an award-winning playwright, and she's just completed Interlock, Art, Conspiracy, and the Shadow Worlds of Mark Lombardi. It is my pleasure to welcome Patricia Goldstone here to Radio Who, What, Why.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Great to have you here. First of all, who was Mark Lombardi? It's not a name that a lot of people instantly recognize.
That's quite true. Mark was a conceptual artist, as you said, which means he essentially drew ideas and not water lilies. Some people consider him to be the first great artist of the century, of the 21st century. He's unique in the art world because he used interlocks to create his art. Now, interlocks are basically a form of flowchart, tracing overly cozy relationships between boards of directors, and they're common in accounting and in some forms of litigation, but they're very, very unusual in the art world. Mark used interlocks to draw what amounts to a continual visual history of the interconnections between intelligence and organized crime and corporations and governments in the shadow banking industry that we've heard so much about since 2007. He was particularly fascinated in tracing things like money laundering and tax evasion. So he was actually way ahead of Edward Snowden and Julian Assange in releasing a very wide swath of extremely uncomfortable information to the public. What he created was a form of visual WikiLeaks. His own life is actually the missing strand in several of the shadowy visual narratives that make up his work, and he died, as you say, a very mysterious death.
Talk a little bit about how Mark first got interested in this shadowy world that he would come to depict in all of these interlocks.
Well, Mark's research skills were well known in the Houston art world, which was very progressive in its politics, at least at that time, through major patrons like the DeMeniels, who were the heirs to the Schlumberger fortune, and the owners of the world-famous DeMeniel collection, and the Rothko Chapel, where Mark was married. Sissy Farenthold, a very prominent Texas politician who once ran for president of the United States, was on the board of the Rothko Chapel, and she met Mark at a gathering, I'm told. Around 1986, Farenthold introduced Mark to an informal investigative salon of young people, in her words, who included a number of lawyers and investigative journalists and prosecutors, etc. She also introduced him to Bill White, who was James R. Bath's former business partner. White was engaged in a long-running series of lawsuits with Bath at the time. So the group was digging into interconnections in the Texas savings and loan scandals and the Iran-Contra funding network. So Mark was tasked to draw out these interconnections in a readable way.
To what extent was Lombardi simply creating this conceptual art, creating these interlocks, from what was the assumed knowledge of the time, as opposed to doing additional work, additional research, to try and find connections that didn't exist out there in the popular press, for example?
That's a very good question. Mark was actually very methodical and systematic in the way that he worked. He worked very much like a historian works. He learned about the flow of hot money largely through published material by well-respected academics and journalists. His library, which I ran through in the course of researching the book, consisted of hundreds of books on the financial debacles he drew, which he rigorously boiled down to bullet points of essentially academically annotated information, which he compiled in thousands of 3x5 index cards. He would arrange these in a narrative design on the floor next to the drawing he was composing, much like a film director uses a storyboard. But as I explain in the book, at that time he was given a very large stash of internal memos and other primary documents by one of the participants in these scandals. These are documents that were never previously published and would be a prize for any serious historian. Also, at the time, I discovered that he was taught how to do interlocks by the lawyer who deposed Adnan Khashoggi, who was one of the major middlemen in the Iran-Contra scandal and in BCCI. So his research was quite professionally grounded.
Who was it that originally recruited Mark to really start doing this political work in Houston?
Well, I would say it was Farenthold. And, he was already rather motivated personally to do it. According to a note I found in his files, which was apparently written by him, he had a personal run-in with the Bushes. And it was hard to put this story together because nobody really wanted to talk about it, not even Mark. But according to what I pieced together, Mark moved down to Houston straight out of Syracuse University to work as a curator at the Contemporary Art Museum of Houston, which was a very important job for such a young man. He was hired to do that by Jim Harrisis, who was the director of the museum and Mark's college teacher and mentor. And from what I understood from a number of sources, under pressure from the board, Harrisis terminated him after a famous impromptu bread fight at a major art opening, which turned into a major brawl when certain of the eminent guests, who were perhaps inflamed by alcohol and the naughty nature of the proceedings, started ripping apart the installation and throwing it around. And a couple of unidentified artists sailed into the melee and started punching up the guests. Now, Mark never spoke about this incident again, and in fact, his ex-wife told me that if the reason for his firing was introduced into a conversation, he would actually get up and leave the room. But in his personal files, I found this note, which looks like it was written by him, and it reads, "In the late 1970s, which is when this incident occurred, I was working as an organizer of art exhibitions in the Houston area. The First International Bank, which was George H.W. Bush's bank, barged into the scene at about this time, effectively vetoing my participation in a large number of projects." And Mark said in this note, which is an addendum to a piece of journalism that he was attempting, that he embarked on his research as a form of revenge.
Was there anybody specifically, a specific individual that he had had a run-in with from the Bush family that really precipitated this?
No. Again, this is sheer conjecture my part, but from the way the note is put together, it almost sounds as if the Bushes might have been present at this gathering.
What happened to all of Mark's file cards after his death?
Well, all of them is kind of a subjective number, because I was told by one major collector of his work that there were as many as 40,000 file cards. This collector had access to his studio. But what is archived at the Museum of Modern Art in Long Island, their facility in Long Island, numbers about 14,000 cards, a considerably smaller number. And when I went to view the cards, all but four on the financial activities of the Bushes, on whom he focused much of his attention, were missing. That really did strike me as extremely odd. I asked the chief archivist if they had archived the Bush material elsewhere, you know, if I had missed it. And she couldn't answer the question. She referred me to the PR department instead.
To what extent was his interest in these things driven by a desire to continue to uncover new stuff, or really to continue to uncover new areas to expand his art and create more interesting interlocks, essentially?
Well, I think that Mark was primarily an artist. I think in many ways he can be considered the heir to Marcel Duchamp, who was the founder of Dada, one of the most important of the early 20th century art movements. Now, Duchamp created his revolutionary art out of ordinary objects like the famous urinal. Mark took another kind of ordinary object, the interlock, and he used it to pursue this main track of thought, how the paths of political influence that he was essentially tracing took shape in flows of hot money. And those flows continually expanded and pooled together over the period of years that he was tracing them. So yes, he was constantly expanding his artwork. In fact, he linked all of his drawings together to form one continual drawing. He called it the one continual drawing in my head.
To what degree did accuracy matter to Mark?
A great deal. As I said, he worked like a historian. And the file cards are amazing because they are very much like what an academic would use in compiling the bibliography and index of a 600-page work. So I think he was very, very scrupulous in his research. Mm-hmm. And he relied on primarily on published material by academics and journalists.
How was he seen in the art world, his early work, and as his work progressed?
He was a late bloomer. He turned out his initial body of work at white hot speed in the mid-1990s, when he was already in his 40s. And he garnered quite a bit of attention with this one body of drawings. He had a solo exhibit in Houston. And the amazing thing about these drawings was that they answered a lot of the questions that John Kerry's Senate Investigating Committee on BCCI, which was winding down at about the same time that Mark was turning out his work. He answered questions that, if you read the Kerry Committee report, they said they didn't have the time or the resources to pursue. And he was this artist sitting on the floor of a tiny studio in Houston pursuing them.
How did the subjects of these pieces of art, those that he really reflected in this interlocking aspect of crime and, as you say, hot money, how did they react to what he was doing?
Well, with some discomfort, as you might expect. I was told a story by one of my interviews that one of Neil Bush's friends came to Mark's first solo show in Houston, and he was looking at a painting on the wall. I think it was the Silverado painting in which Neil figures, and he remarked to someone, "Well, I'm going to have to tell Neil that he is represented here."
Talk a little bit about the evolution of his work. How did it progress? How were some of his later work and later interlocks different from the early ones?
Well, the work became much more complex as he progressed, because it all interconnected. So the genesis of his work really was a huge bank called BCCI that some people may not remember. It was a bank that billed itself as Bank of America for the Third World, but in fact it was the CIA's first global money laundry. And BCCI was very connected to the subprime crises of the 1970s and 1980s, and it was officially closed down in the 1990s. But Mark really developed all of his drawings from his initial two boxes of research into BCCI, and he ended up in this immense continual series of drawings that makes up his work, tracing the genesis of BCCI all the way back to a trove of stolen World War II plunder.
Talk about the FBI and the CIA and their interest in Mark's work.
Well, the FBI, the CIA, the Department of Defense, and the Office of Naval Research, actually, all had to study Mark's work in the wake of 9/11, which wasn't really made public until my book came out. They were looking for clues to terrorist social networks. That's a subject Mark covered in some of his drawings, and also for traffic analysis tools, which is kind of a funny story, because although the NSA, which is also studied Mark's work, may be very good at collecting data on all of us, they're not terrific at analyzing it. And when they feed it into a main computer, the visualization tends to come out looking like what they call in-house spaghetti. In other words, it's very messy and dense and hard to read. But Mark's work is actually used in the computer science world now to study traffic analysis, because he spaced his players in a particular way that makes them very easy to read and sort of aesthetically pleasing, and directs the eye in certain ways.
Tell us a little bit about Mark as a personality. What was he like?
Well, he was a fascinating person. He was a working-class guy from Syracuse, New York, who had nothing more than a bachelor's in fine arts. And he was intensely ambitious, untrained in finance or anything like it, but very, very quick intuitively. And his great talent as an artist was to be able to apprehend a lot of visual information all at once, and to get at the big picture that lies below the surface of things. You know, I suppose many people would call him obsessive. People have tended to use Asperger's as an explanation for his ability to focus very intensely for very long periods of time. I don't think that is quite fair or true. Mark was very charming, very funny, exuberant, impish, intensely attractive to women, and very good socially when he wanted to be, and very good verbally. And he was a shrewd communicator and a cunning player of the art game, who never quite revealed what he was really up to. I mean, nobody in the art world, for example, had a clue that he had actually created his work out of interlocks.
Talk about what happened in March of 2000.
Mark was in the process of opening a very important show at PS1, which is one of the iconic exhibition spaces in New York. And everything seemed to be going beautifully for him. He was getting attention. He was getting a great deal of critical acclaim. People were lining up to buy his work. He was making money, which had always been an issue for him. His personal life was a bit rocky, but that was not unusual. He had recently broken up with a girlfriend, depending on who you talk to, and I heard many, many different renditions of this story in the course of interviewing over 80 people who knew him over a 50-year period. Depending on who you talk to, he was either happy about that or unhappy about that, but he was certainly seeing other women at the time. So he had a suspicious flood in his studio about 3 weeks before the show opened. His masterwork, which was the third version of his BCCI series, was very badly water damaged. And this drawing is remarkable because he actually strung all of his previous drawings together on a series of timelines so that you can see exactly how all the scandals from the 1970s onwards sort of add up to this one huge scandal, which was BCCI. That painting was almost destroyed, but it does remain readable today. So Mark recreated it in a mad workspace. He reconstructed the whole drawing in the space of about 4 days, and some people say that the strain of doing that drove him into a suicidal depression. I don't quite buy that, because he did open the show very successfully with the drawing that he had recreated, and people told me that he was quite happy with that drawing. And regardless, about 3 weeks later, he was found hanged in his studio. And the police reports, which I got hold of in the beginning of my research, were rather sketchy. A lot of things didn't ring true. The time of death was never established, for one. Establishing death by hanging is a controversial area of forensic pathology. And the police based their very hasty verdict of death by suicide on the testimony of one witness who appeared increasingly unreliable during the interview process. I actually did track down the two cops who found him, and one of them, who was a rookie at the time, was still very disturbed by the experience. He was the policeman who actually pushed open the transom, which is how they got into Mark's studio, and there was Mark staring him straight in the face because he'd been hanged from a sprinkler pipe, and he had an open bottle of champagne suspended beside him in this... This cop said to me, you know, I've never really seen anyone take a drink on the way out.
Talk about the flood. What is it that made it suspicious? What do we know about that?
Well, it was a sprinkler flood. And, you know, a lot of rumor and conjecture exists in the art world about Mark's suicide / death / murder. But... one artist told me what sounded like a rather implausible story, that he had tried to hang himself earlier at the time of this flood from one of the sprinkler pipes, and that his weight is what broke the pipe, and that's what caused the flood. That's actually, it's very difficult for that kind of a factor to trigger a flood. I mean, sprinkler pipes go off because of fire. Or they can go off because of a sharp blow applied to a pipe from an upstairs apartment, to the gauge on the pipe, or to heat applied to that gauge. That can trigger a flood in a downstairs apartment. But someone suspending himself from a sprinkler pipe, no, that's not very likely. Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about whether or not there was any history of depression or mental illness or anything else with respect to him.
No, there was no clinical history of depression. In retrospect, certain members of Mark's family told me that they felt he was depressed. However, his mother, who was really the closest person to him, told me before she died, she died in 2012, very sadly, she told me that she had talked to him a couple of days before he was found, and he said he was absolutely jubilant at the success his work had brought him and at the prospect of moving in with his girlfriend. So, you know, a lot of this just doesn't compute.
The police report after his death and all the investigation was, as you talk about, a bit sketchy. Talk about that. And was that normal at the time in terms of police procedure, or was that unusual?
Well, the circumstances surrounding his death were really quite strange. He had no clinical history of depression. His mother, to whom he was closest and to whom he spoke almost daily, told me that he had told her that he was actually very happy a couple of days, before he died. And I believe that, because Mark was quite single-mindedly ambitious, and he was getting the success that he had worked for decades by this time to achieve. He may have been unhappy at the breakup of a relationship, but he was extremely attractive to women and extremely attracted to women. And, in fact, he was seeing somebody else at the time. So I actually began my research by getting hold of the police reports through a friend of mine in the homicide division in New York. And there were a lot of things that didn't ring quite true. A time of death was never established, for one thing, and that's very important in this kind of an investigation. It's standard procedure. And establishing death by hanging is a controversial area of forensic pathology. That and the fact that the police based their very hasty verdict of death by suicide, they closed the case within 2 days, on the testimony of one witness who appeared increasingly unreliable during the interview process. I actually ended up tracking down the two cops who found him, and one of them, who was a rookie at the time, showed signs of doubt. That and their other pillar of evidence, which was the absence of signs of struggle and the fact that the door was securely locked from the inside, are also questionable, as I explain in my book. But then, you know, there's the exact nature of what's in the drawings, which could, of course, want any number of people to want them dead.
Is there anything in the drawings, all of them, that was what we would classify, I suppose, as original material? One of the things you've talked about is that in many ways he worked based upon academic reports and journalism and all the material that he could get his hands on. And he was great at bringing all of this together in these interlocks. But was there anything in this material that was revealing of anything that hadn't been revealed anywhere else?
Well, I did find in his files a large cache of internal memos and other primary documents from James Arbath's company, Skyways. And some of these connections come up in the George W. Bush, Harkin Energy, Jackson Stevens drawing, which was of interest to the FBI after Mark's death.
Did the FBI ever do anything with any of that, to your knowledge?
Well, it's widely known that the FBI went to the Whitney after Mark died to look at one of his big BCCI drawings. But the FBI was really interested in the relationship between Khalid bin Mahfouz, who was banker to the Saudi royals, and certain Islamic charities in Virginia that were allegedly funding al-Qaeda that the FBI ended up raiding in 2002. And there are some clues to those interconnections in Lombardi's George W. Bush, Harkin Energy, and Jackson Stevens drawing, which focuses on Bush's oil companies. Mm-hmm. Now, bin Mahfouz allegedly bankrolled Arbusto, which was one of George W. Bush's companies, through James Bath, who represented Saudi business interests in America. And one of the documents I did find in Mark's files was a copy of a 1976 trust agreement between James Bath and Salim bin Laden, who was Osama's older brother and who died in a mysterious plane crash in Texas a few years later. Bin Mahfouz was also allegedly the real owner of Bath's aircraft leasing company, Skyways. Now, interestingly, bin Mahfouz himself doesn't actually appear in this drawing. However, Salim bin Laden does, and also Abdullah Taha Baksh, who was a major Harkin shareholder and CEO of a Halliburton subsidiary who had close ties to bin Mahfouz, does appear as a central hub or connection along with James Bath. And so does Baksh's representative on the Harkin board, an influential businessman named Talat Osman, who opened the 2000 Republican National Convention with a Muslim benediction on Bush's behalf and later successfully protested the FBI raid on these Virginia charities in a private meeting with Bush's Treasury Secretary, Paul O'Neill.
If not suicide, where does your speculation or where can speculation lead in terms of the cause of Mark's death?
Well, I have to point out that Mark was actually pretty equal opportunity in his finger pointing. he did focus a lot of attention on the Bushes for the reasons I go into in the book, and he did die during a hotly contested presidential election in which at least one of his drawings might have had an impact. But he did a number of important drawings that focus attention on the Clintons and their links with the Lippo Group of Indonesia and the Riady family, who were the sources of Chinese influence peddling in the U.S. during Clinton's administration. Also, Mark Rich, who was famously connected to the Clintons, was one of the key middlemen that hooked Mark's drawings together, as was Jackson Stevens, who funded both the Bush and the Clinton campaigns. So, you know, overall, Mark was really more like a social scientist than a political partisan, and that I believed his overwhelming interest was in getting this whole financial system of systems down on paper for everyone to see. And in fact, he had reportedly been threatened in the late 1990s. He got a call from someone telling him to back off investigating the five major New York crime families, who were the subject of a preparatory sketch he had been working on. He mentioned this to a Williamsburg publication, and it was repeated after his death by a German freelance journalist. So there are a lot of names in these drawings. One of them told me that he wouldn't know a Lombardi drawing from the Mona Lisa.
In the material that you've uncovered since, in your investigation and your work on this, does it lead any place in particular?
Well, you know, I have to be careful to point out that I don't have anything like a smoking gun, and I don't have the power to subpoena people, and I got many, many, many different stories from almost everyone I talked to on this subject. But certainly, you know, the heft of circumstantial evidence makes me feel that in a minimum, a lot more questions should have been asked at the time of his death. The fact that they weren't makes me queasy.
And is it your conclusion that really suicide just seems the most unlikely scenario?
Well, it's not my impression of Mark as a human being. You know, he was tremendously vital and totally committed to his work. As I said, he was getting where he wanted to go. And he was quite ebullient, really, as a person, very high energy. Now, of course, you know, I didn't know the man. And it's always possible for certain personality types to be very volatile. And from what people told me, he was, particularly when he'd been drinking. But, no, it it doesn't stack up with where he was going in his life at the time, because he was really on the verge of very major success.
Is there any evidence that he was on to something, or that he had made a connection, or that his research had taken him somewhere that was new and heretofore undiscovered?
Well, that's an interesting question. One of his drawings, one of his late drawings, is a drawing called George Bush, Harkin Energy, and Jackson Stevens. And that drawing focuses on relationships that apparently, and my source for this was a rather obscure intelligence newsletter that came out in March of 2000 and said that the Bush campaign might run into trouble over the Bush relationship with Khalid bin Mahfouz, who was banker to the Saudi royals and very much a presence in Houston. And this drawing that Mark had done had focused on that relationship.
What was the interest like in his work after his death?
Well, his prices took off, certainly. One of his larger drawings recently went up for sale at one of the most prominent art galleries in the country, priced at $450,000. He's been quite avidly collected. The Whitney has a major holding of his work. The Museum of Modern Art has a major holding of his work. A number of eminent computer scientists collect his work. There's a man named Robert Tolksdorf in Germany who I think, owns four of the drawings. And Robert, whom I interviewed, is engaged in trying to convert Mark's drawings into hypertext, string text, which means, you know, you click on a name right. and it pulls up the whole history through the drawings. The problem that he told me he had had in completing this was that so many of the drawings are not available for view because they're in private collections.
Is there any work that disappeared after his death that anybody is aware of?
Well, the George Bush Park and Energy drawing did migrate to Germany for quite a number of years. It's back in the United States now. Some people that I interviewed said they felt that drawings had disappeared from his studio, but his studio was not actually very well secured by the police after his death, so it's impossible to substantiate that.
Patricia Goldstone, the book is Interlock, Art, Conspiracy, and the Shadow Worlds of Mark Lombardi. Patricia, thanks so much for spending time with us here on Radio Who, What, Why.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you. And thank you for listening and joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why. I hope you'll join us next week for another Radio Who, What, Why podcast. I'm Jeff Shekman. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share it and help other people find it by rating and reviewing it on iTunes. You can also support this podcast and all the work we do by going to whowhatwhy.org/donate.